Big questions, of course, can our health service cope with an outbreak of coronavirus? Because quite clearly, in many ways, our health service is broken. So how do you fix a health system? It's a question that there appears to be no answer, especially here in Ireland. But some do make a better go of it than others do. And one of those people is with me because he ran the NHS in the United Kingdom for 6 years. Now, to put in perspective the scale of that task, the NHS is the world's fifth largest employer. Who are bigger than the NHS? Well, McDonald's, Walmart, and the militaries of China and the USA. And after that, you're talking about the British NHS. 1.7 million employees. It's effectively the size of a nation state in itself. And I suppose many people see it as one of the defining aspects of British identity. So how do you keep that particular show on the road? Well, with me is Lord Nigel Crisp, an independent member of the House of Lords and formerly the senior manager, the boss of the NHS. Nigel, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you headed up one of the biggest organisations in the world. What does that feel like, to be in charge of so many people?
A great privilege to have a chance to sort of try and make a real difference. But you never knew where things were coming from, because huge organisation, 1.4 million people, and of course very politically exposed. So you found yourself working long-term, on long-term plans, and on 5 minutes, if you see what I mean.
How difficult was political interference in your job?
It varied. Very interestingly, I was in for 6 years. In the middle 4 years, we had alignment between the Prime Minister, the Secretary of State, their advisers, me, the Chief Medical Officer, the Chief Nursing Officer, and we had what I thought of as a guiding coalition. So about nine people, we were all pointing in the right, same direction, and we made real change. And that's really key. You need to get everyone pointing in the same direction.
So why is the NHS in crisis in Britain at the moment then?
Hospitals have got fuller. Cuts have been made at the same time, and they've been made in the community. And that just throws the pressure onto the hospitals. So I've seen this in mental health, for example. And I think this is, you know, this needs to be reversed.
There were some guiding principles to the actions that you took when you were in charge of the NHS. One of those was to make people accountable. In other words, if something goes wrong, they do put their hands up. How did you do that?
Well, that was very difficult, and it was quite a cultural change, and it was resisted in a lot of ways. We did it sometimes with like crude methods, which was sort of league tables, and you sort of listed the worst performers and the best performers. Now, you can do that. Maybe that gives a shock to the system. But longer term, what you've got to be doing is you've got to be helping people to get better. You know, so a bit of pressure, a bit of accountability, but also, where are the new ideas? Are we feeding them into the system? Are we making sure that people are using modern best practice?
Did you find that there were vested interest groups which resisted all change?
Of course there are. There are in any organisation, in any area. There will be people, and think about it in health. You know, doctors, for example, trained for 25 years to do something, and then suddenly people are saying, actually, we don't need you to do those operations in that way. They can be done by somebody else in the community. This is a big change. So that's vested interest, but it's also, if you like, the sort of baggage of history. You know, you can understand where they're coming from.
Now, you are not a medical man by background.
That's right.
So how do you take on these guys? Because normally, culturally, the consultant is God.
And consultant and doctors are fantastically important. Let's be clear. The health service is about the people. But I, as an outsider, took advice, you know. So I always made sure that I had really good medics around me, really good nurses around me. And I'd like to say a bit more about nurses because I think they're the future. Nurses and doctors around me who would give me good advice. I knew who I could listen to. And then I needed to be fairly robust as the manager in the situation to say, actually, look, you know, you may be saying that, but actually I've got other medical advice that is saying this. I never tried to second guess a doctor myself. I always had another doctor do it, if you see what I mean.
I remember when Jerry Robinson went into the NHS. Do you remember that?
That was after my time, actually. So,
but he went in, and one of the things he found was a lack of identification among people who worked in a hospital with the tasks they were charged with, partly because they started to outsource things. So the cleaners were outsourced. So the people who came in didn't identify, as you would with your football team, formerly the hospital cleaners who were employed on staff, took great pride in getting things done in the way that nuns used to get things done in Ireland. That kind of outsourcing, is that still going on? And is it the wrong way to go?
It depends on the circumstance. I mean, I do believe that sometimes health systems can get too cosy. You know, people can get used to doing things in a certain way. And sometimes you just need to use a bit of force, as it were, to make change happen. And that may be the threat of outsourcing, the threat of competition. I've actually observed that the threat of competition can make an enormous change. We actually had very long waiting lists for cataracts. Now, cataracts are a very short operation, very important for older people. We brought in some South African surgeons and we got them to do some operations, and it changed the way that our British cataract surgeons changed.
I remember that. There was war. Yeah. Initially, when the idea of this crack team of South Africans coming in and doing the operations, and they could do it at a speed, at a pace, and deliver in a way that the surgeons had not been doing in the NHS. What happened to the productivity of the surgeons in the NHS?
Well, if I tell you that at that time in England, waiting lists for cataracts were 2 years in Surrey, but about 3 months in the centre of London. After about 6 months, it was no more than 6 months everywhere. You know, it really changed because people saw this as a threat. It was a threat of competition. Now, I prefer to work through working with people, encouraging people, supporting them, helping them to learn best practice. But sometimes, candidly, I will say I have two hands. One is the tough hand that holds to account, and the other one is the other hand which helps and supports. And that's where we should be, because these are good people, you know. People working in health are well motivated, and we should be supporting them.
Now, you talk about the importance of nurses and how if nurses got to do more, allow their productivity to improve, because they are capable of doing much more than they are asked to do. Where is the barrier to them doing more?
I don't think people have quite understood that nurses are very well trained. I think the future is going to be very largely about nursing, because as we get older as nations, we get more non-communicable diseases. And I can see that primary care, community work and so on, nurse, this is the territory where nurses are going to be really big.
Give me some examples of the kind of things they would do that they don't do now that require a doctor.
So, for example, you know, we know that in any neighbourhood, about 5% of the people in the neighbourhood consume about 90% of the health resources. And you know who they are. They're older people with chronic diseases. Now, if you actually target them and go and work with them so that you've got older people in the community who you know are going to have an incident every 3 weeks or so, why don't you check up on them every 2 weeks? You know, head it off. You know, you can't solve the hospital problem from inside the hospitals.
But could you have nurses prescribing, for instance?
We do. In England, in my time, we introduced nurse prescribing. Made a big difference.
And in terms of doing things like suturing?
Yeah, absolutely. And and they're doing minor surgery as well in England.
What do you think the reason is that nurses are not allowed to work to the maximum of their capabilities and training?
There's history here. And part of the history is that nurses have almost always been women. And how a society treats women is often how they've treated nurses. And I think our campaign at the moment is to say, look again at nurses. Understand these are real professionals. These are not handmaidens to doctors. They can actually do a whole range of things that maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago they couldn't. But they're much better trained now, but they've still got that care and compassion. But there is a gender issue here. You know, there is a bit still about the fact that nursing is seen as a women's profession. We need more men in nursing as well.
So is it the male hierarchy in medicine who are holding the women back?
Health services and decision-making have been dominated by men. And within that, and you hear the same stories about women doctors trying to get on within medicine, it's changing. It's changing quite fast. Nursing is seen generally as a profession which is mostly women, and partly because of that, they are, I think, unable to work to the top of their licence.
So looking to our problems here, and, you know, in a typical flu season, we have people on trolleys, but even in the middle of summer, we have people on trolleys who can't get access because there isn't a hospital bed. Mm. Sometimes because of that terrible term, bed blockers, people who could be discharged, but there's nowhere for them to go. That's one of the big problems. The other big problem is the waiting list issue to which you've referred.
Yeah.
What do we need to do?
If I were looking at the Irish health system, I would centre it around invest heavily in nurses. And this isn't just because I'm here for a great nursing conference with the wonderful Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland here, but because I do believe that if you get more nurse-led clinic, if you get more nurse-led care in the community, it won't be a quick solution. It'll take you 2 or 3 years before you really see change happening. But if you invest in the community, people will be happier. They'll like to work with nurses. And an awful lot of the conditions that people have, and the ones where you not only get bed blockers, dreadful word, you get frequent flyers, people who are in and out quite often, you know, terrible terms. But why aren't those people being looked after at home? Because we can predict they're going to come in. So the more that you invest in the community, the more you invest in prevention, the more you invest in nurses, the better chance you're going to have of running a health system that is robust and can deal with the pressures that will come.
In an interview you gave, you remarked that many patients feel more at home with a nurse than with the doctor, because they feel as if they're speaking to someone on the same level as themselves.
Well, this is true. I mean, nurses have a great advantage. They are of the community they work in, you know, so people, they know the culture and so on. Doctors and managers, you know, we dip in and out, whereas nurses manage the continuity of care.
When the NHS was started up, even its great architect, Bevan, predicted that there would never be enough. There would never be enough resources, no matter what. And that really is a self-fulfilling prophecy. The better you get at it, the more you're asked to do.
There are some things happening in our health system in the UK, and I've seen elsewhere, that are just unacceptable. And that's not about not having enough money in some places. It's just we're not doing well enough.
You talk about having teams, action teams. How does that work?
For example, on orthopaedics and hips, you know, the terrible thing that if somebody doesn't get their hip repaired, if they've broken their hip, within 72 hours, that's really very bad for them. You get action teams of the people who are involved. You know, this is the clinicians and the others who are on the grassroots, as it were, in the surgery. They're the people who know what to do, and you empower them to come up with best practice, and then you have to work out how to spread that elsewhere. They are accountable, but more important than that, they own the problem. If I've got a problem in a hospital, I want to know what those doctors and the nurses in that hospital think they can do about it.
The future, an ageing population, ageing demographics on these islands, we're slightly better than you are because we've a relatively young population, but inevitably the demographics will demand more medical care for older people. And you believe the only way that that can be done is not in hospitals. It cannot be done. We won't have enough hospital buildings. It'll have to be done in the community.
Oh, it's simpler than that. I don't want to be in a hospital when I'm older. I want to be at home. There's a great expression, digital health has got two meanings. One's about technology. The other's about hands-on care. And the combination of remote monitoring, so a doctor somewhere can actually look at my heartbeat or whatever, but at the same time, good, compassionate people can come and actually work with me in my home. That's where I want to be when I'm old. I don't want to be in some hospital bed.
Since you worked for the NHS at the highest level as the boss, I'm sure it's a bit like a favourite child. Mm. How do you think it's being looked after by the politicians at the moment, and the idea, the spectre that some elements of it might be privatised?
The NHS has always bought things from the private sector, whether it's food or drugs or tests or bought in care or whatever. I don't think that there's any going to be any wholesale privatisation of the NHS.
Finally, coronavirus, COVID-19, a pandemic looming, and how serious might that be?
If you look at the Spanish flu of
1918,
there were three waves. There was a first wave which died out. People then thought it was going to be okay, and then there was another wave that came back. So it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen, and not least if the virus mutates or whatever. Now, I'm no expert on this, so I think people are being sensible, watching, putting in the precautions they can. Whether it now starts to improve or whether it gets worse, I have no idea. Mm.
The Spanish flu killed young people rather than older people. And my suspicion would be that the older people had come across this virus at some earlier stage in their lives and had developed an immune response to it, whereas the young people were seeing it for the first time. We're all seeing COVID-19 for the first time.
It's good to see that people are taking sensible precautions.
And we are a global family.
It demonstrated it extraordinarily well, how dependent we are on everyone in the world.
Lord Nigel Crisp is in Dublin today. As we mentioned, he'll be receiving an honorary fellowship from the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, Faculty of Nursing at Midwifery. And he is an independent member of the House of Lords, former senior manager, the top dog in the NHS. Nigel, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you, Pat.